Hello, friends. In some ways, we're always having this conversation about the divine, that fundamental bass note, the third strand, aka God. In this episode, Greg Meyer reminds us that while it's hard for us to wrap our heads around the concept, let alone speak about it, it's worth using that imperfect language we have to keep growing and uncovering the divine wonder within and around us, aka God.
Back in 2006, 16 years ago, I was in the early process of starting what became this, and there were some people that I kind of needed to get a green light from. You know those people, good people. They were lifelong church folks, cared deeply about the church, wonderful, wonderful folks. And they came up to you at one point and said, "We love what you're doing, but like, why do you have to be so crazy with it? Like, why do you have to reinvent church? Why do you have to, look all over again, you know, find different ways to talk about God and rethink how we use the Bible and kind of mess with the sacraments and all that kind of stuff. Like, do you really have to do all that kind of stuff?" And I just said, "Here, get in the car with me." So they got in the car and we drove about 7 blocks to a little store on 36th and Grand Avenue, just across the highway here, called Present Moments. Yeah, there you go. Ever been there? I said, "Let's go inside, just look around a little bit. It's all about spirituality. Some of you may have been there." And it was busy. It was full of people that were a lot like them and even more so a lot like their grown kids, you know? And but they didn't know any of these people. And they looked around, it was all this spirituality stuff. And books, shelves and shelves and shelves of books about spirituality. I directed them to the section on Christianity. It was about this wide and 4 shelves. And not the kind of books that were in their church libraries, or probably their shelves at home. The books that they did have weren't on Christian theology or biblical studies. It was more like prayer, meditation, liberation theology, stuff like that. And they had no idea that this place existed, even though it was right in their neighborhood. And they had no idea that a place like this would be busy all the time. And they just were shocked. And I said, "This is why I'm doing it." Now, it wasn't to counter that. It wasn't to correct that. No, it was to meet that. I mean, the people in our neighborhood, their friends, their neighbors had deep spiritual needs. They were trying to figure stuff out. They were looking for things. The stuff that was on that Christianity shelf just wasn't quite relevant to what their needs, the way it was packaging what this spiritual life is all supposed to be about and how it detailed it and articulated it wasn't quite meeting their needs or talking to the stuff that really mattered in their lives. So they were looking for other stuff, and I think that's a pretty good thing to be doing. I assured them that God is not restricted to those, you know, 3 shelves of 42-inch wide shelves. God was a lot bigger than that shelf. In fact, God was a lot bigger than anything that could be in this store. And that was a challenge we needed to meet. You know, where is God for people these days? So welcome to our second week of AKA God, also known as God. I'm Greg Meyer, and I'm thoroughly convinced that it is beyond time to quit leaning on those 3 letters, G-O-D, so heavily, and start exploring what else God is known as, right? And last week, just to kind of fill you in if you weren't here, didn't listen to the podcast, but we talked about the truth of our inability to ever fully comprehend what God is or what God is about. And I also kind of took you on a tour of how the Bible tries to give us a display, an image, an idea of what God, what we talk about with God is. And spoiler alert, it isn't much like how we've kind of seen God and portrayed God from our Western society's popular image of what God is and how God works and stuff like that. And then, in fact, you know, the people in the Bible were really focusing on something we've translated in English as the Lord, but if you go back, that which is sort of a title, But if you go back to wherever that word, the Lord, those words, the Lord, comes from, it's in Hebrew, it's Yahweh, which means I am who I am. Like, what kind of name is that? That's sort of like the name of something that you can't define. And it's a name. It isn't a title. We also talked about the fact that talking about just God or the Lord in the context of our society today is not only inadequate to really capture what this, whatever it is that is behind the existence of all things, it's inadequate to that, but it's also deeply compromised. Like I said, like that store showed us, so many people, they hear that and are just, what, tuned out and turned off. And it's time for us to think more deeply. It's time for us to find ways where we can all connect, and not just other people. I mean, this is us too, right? Where we connect with this sort of stuff. And so as I also kind of warned you all that, as we probably, you've noticed we've been struggling with for years, finding ways to say and talk about that which is behind all existence, that which it weaves the fabric of our lives, other than just saying God. So sometimes I say God. Sometimes I'll say Yahweh, which is the Hebrew name. I am who I am, or just I am, or talk about the third strand, right? A metaphor we use here a lot of for a strand being of ourselves, our true selves, one of all others, including non-people others, like all others, and then this third strand, the one that we can't really define, the one that is, we try to sum up inadequately with that name, God. Anyway, if you want to know more about that, go back to last week's podcast and kind of catch up with us. But this week, I want to talk about how we learn to think and talk about this I am who I am. And here's a dilemma. 20th century philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein put it well when he said, "The limits of my language are the limits of my world." I think he's absolutely right. Like our emotions, if we can't name them, we have a hard time recognizing them. And if we can't recognize them, we have a harder time knowing how to handle them, how to use them in our lives, and we end up just being used by them. Likewise, with language that expresses what we know that third strand to be about and helps us kind of explore that and open it up for us, we have a hard time understanding our relationship with it or how to align with it, how to live in sync with that, how to, you know, partner with it in this world that we're in. So, yeah, you have outlines there if you want to take a look at those. The first takeaway from this is words can help us understand. They can help us grasp something, and that's important. That's the advantage. Without a word, we have a real hard time understanding something. We need that. The disadvantage is this. Language, having a word for something, can also reduce it to what that word means to us already. Or to put it another way, the thing itself, God in this case, often becomes defined by the word, limited by the word, rather than letting whatever our experience with God is define that word God, we let the word God, what, limit what God actually is. And that's a problem, and we do it all the time. We do it with lots of things. Once we have a word for something, we don't have to look any closer. We don't need to rethink it. We can dismiss it because holding that word, being able to name it, is enough for us, and then we mentally move on. We don't examine it. We don't try to find out more about it. And so what does God mean? So you may notice a picture of God. That's God, right? I mean, anybody, when that image came up, didn't know that that was God? Anybody here actually think God looks like that?
Yeah.
No. Right. I mean, it just is a perfect example of it all. The powerful old world version of a king, and that's what God is. Now, whether you intellectually agree with that or not, the fact that that is the image colors your ability to understand who God is, what God is. And then there's Jesus. Wow. What a... You know... A really nice, gentle, good-looking white guy with long, dishwater blonde hair who wouldn't offend anyone, especially people who like to look like that, you know? You know, the words God or Jesus bring images, if those words bring images to your mind like that, you've got a problem. Got a problem. Because, like Wittgenstein said, our words... limit. I mean, they not only give us a base, they not only give us a container to hold ideas with, they also often come with a lid that keeps and limits what's ever going to fit in that box for us. And that becomes a real problem for us. So that brings us to our God boxes, right? OK, container that can hold something, but a lid that limits it, probably unfairly, okay? Here's the truth. You all have a God box. Whether you know it or not, whether you want to admit it or not, whether you think you believe in God or not, whether you think God exists or not, the fact that you can say, this is what I think God is, and therefore I don't believe in God, means you've got a God box. You've got ideas, language, names, preconceptions of what God is, so that you can choose to either say yes to it or no to it or I don't know about it, right? We all have a God box. It's something we need to be honest about. Now, in your God box are things like we talked about at the end of the gathering last week, when I asked you to kind of just close your eyes and imagine this space that holds your experience with God, with religion, with faith, with whatever that transcendent part of your world and experience is, and think about all the furnishings and stuff in there. That's the kind of stuff that is in this God box. It's the names you might have for God, or the ways that you have of thinking about God, the metaphors, the meaning that those things have for you. Maybe it's all the stuff that you were taught in classes, or the places and experiences you associate with the divine, or with deciding that the divine doesn't exist, convincing you of that. Childhood memories, emotions that get tied up when you get into this sphere of these kinds of thoughts and questions. Those are all in here too. Traditions maybe that your family had, traditions that you have now, Bible verses, stories. I mean, all sorts of stuff is inside of this box. Now, where did you get your box? Some of it was inherited by your family, or it was just such a constant idea in society that you just ended up holding it too, didn't even know it, just ended up in your hands. Some parts that you chose, other parts got picked up by chance. Just what happened in the experiences you had. You were born in, well, most of us, I think, were born in the United States. That said a lot about what our God boxes were going to be looking like just because of that geography. There are other parts of the room that your God box that you are conscious of, and there are parts that you are unconscious of. All of them, however, whatever is in here, influences how you think about, how you understand what you let God be for you. Now, so here's the deal about God boxes. First of all, you need one. You need a God box, all right? You need ways to understand and to talk about Yahweh, God, the third strand, I am who I am, whatever, right? Those spiritually meaningful things to you. Can you imagine being in a family where nobody had a name, but you had to function and work out life every day? Can you imagine being told to fix that car, but no part on the car had a name or a description of what it did and how? It would be impossible. We couldn't function that way. We need words. We need we need concrete stuff to help us understand what these God boxes are all about for ourselves. We can't. There's no way to do that. And that your God box isn't big enough. I mean, that's always going to be true. Still, no matter, you know, what your God box is, this one or this one, it isn't the one you were born with, right? The very early childhood one, or maybe the one you progressed to by the time you're in second grade or something like that. You know, your God box is in there someplace. So there are a couple of keys to these God boxes. And the first is this. You have a God box, right? First of all, admit it, but use it. Use your God box, but don't live in it. Use it, don't live in it. You need it, but your God box isn't it, all right? It's just what you've got right now. It is meant to grow. When it comes to God boxes, rent, don't buy, right? That's my advice. Basically, you're not going to be staying there long enough. At least you shouldn't be staying there long. You need to keep a little bit more mobile. You need to be able to change where that is. Even if your life isn't challenging your God box and breaking it open and making you ask new questions, the society you live in is changing so fast that the challenges that are going to be brought to your God box are going to make a change for you. So, you know, rent, don't buy. Or another way to say it, you know, like hermit crabs, when your shell has gotten too small, you know, ditch it. Or I like how cowboys say it, when the horse is dead, dismount. That's how we need to treat those things. Now, one of the things that keeps the third strand so captive and jailed in our God box when it has become far too small for it and it really doesn't fit in there anymore, is something called anthropomorphism. Hard word for even me to get out right. Anthropomorphism. Anthropos, human. Morphos, shape. Human-shaped. It's our human tendency to attribute our own emotions, our ideas, our motivations, our feelings to something that isn't a person, right? We do it all the time. For instance, where's a picture of that? There you go. Like, that rose is so sad. That rose sad. I mean, I think a pep talk and a hug probably isn't going to make it stand up any straighter. Now, maybe trimming the bottom of the stem and putting some fresh water in the vase, that could help. But then again, I don't really really recommend that's what you do with your two-year-old when they're not feeling really happy, right? I mean, but we do this all the time. We attribute our own ideas. We project our way of thinking, our motives, our ideas, our thoughts, our feelings onto other things, and we assume that that is true. And the fact is, it isn't. Now, last week I mentioned that in the very first chapter of the book, the chapter of the Bible, in this poetic telling of how creation comes to be, which is really all about relationships. It's not science. It's not history. It's really trying to help us understand things. One of the things that it says is, and God created humankind in God's own image. Now, there are two points being made there. One is, there is something in us that reflects that which is at the center of the universe, so that we are able to resonate with, understand, participate with that which is this I am who I am, right? And the other thing that it says is, we're created in God's image. God's not created in our image. Anthropomorphism is creating God in our image. And while there can be sometimes ability, you know, things that help us identify and understand God that way, it gets in trouble really fast because, in case you didn't know it, we're not God, right? I've mentioned this quote from Anne Lamott a couple of times because I think it is so good, but it speaks perfectly to this, and that is, you know you have created God in your own image when your God hates all the same people you hate. Not a bad check for ourselves. It doesn't have to be so negative, though. You also know you've created God in your own image when God agrees with you on everything, when God has all the same stands, all the same, you know, asks all the same questions. Or you know you have created God in your own image when your God fits in your God box too comfortably. Because God never actually fits in any of our boxes. You know, if we aren't dealing with a God box that has been prescribed to us, and that we're all kind of victim to being stuck in it, if that's not true, how come when I Google God or Jesus, all the images I get are like that? I mean, society has prescribed something that is neither true to what the Bible tries to describe, nor to what our, I think, deepest wonderings, experiences, learnings reveal to us. Yeah, I think that's a problem. So the question is, you know, does our God box decide and limit what God can be, or do we let I am who I am always burst out of it? I don't know if you guys caught the news story. This is back in February, but thousands of baptisms were invalidated by there's a priest in Arizona named Andre Arango. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his name, who was baptizing people, kids and adults, by saying, we baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, instead of I baptize you. So one word wrong, and they invalidated all those baptisms. And in the Catholic Church, I mean, that's not just a ritual. I mean, this is actually something changes about who you are as a person in that. And so therefore, any other sacraments that you participated in, marriage, confession, communion, those are also all invalid, because the fundamental one never worked. That one word being wrong meant those didn't work. So one word can make God not able or willing to or whatever Sounds like a God box to me. I was deeply encouraged by a lot of the people that went to that church that said, this doesn't make sense to us. I mean, this priest has been fabulous. He has made us feel like we're in the presence of God as a community, and his ministry among us has been so powerful. How can that make sense? How can God be so powerful there, but then be stopped by one word? The temptation then was, well, the theological experts from the church said, well, we instead of I makes all the difference, and you are being theologically naive. That's why you think it doesn't matter, whereas perhaps the fact that they could see a God that was big enough that couldn't be stopped by a priest using a wrong or a different word maybe meant that they weren't naive, but the theologians were stuck. I know, I'm getting a little judgmental there, which is the next key to how to live with God boxes, and that would be don't judge the God boxes of others or of your own, right? Don't judge the God boxes of others or of your own. The purpose of your God box isn't to pronounce, this is what God is like, and be absolutely right, and you then that becomes the standard for other people, or someone else's is a standard for other people that you need to conform to that. No, our God boxes are the place where we keep that experience, that language, the ideas, what we have right now so that we can then ask the next set of questions. We can experience the things. We can find the stuff that works, that doesn't work. Someone else's might look bigger or smaller or more profound or more simplistic or more highly developed or more naive or whatever. But frankly, that doesn't matter. Comparison, when it comes to these kinds of parts of our lives, comparison is a disease. It is not a medicine. It does not help us. It gets in the way. It makes something go wrong within us. The God box of that other person is what they're dealing with right now, just like yours is. They don't need yours. Ask questions when you want to disagree or are worried about someone else's God box. Don't tell them what's right or wrong because you don't know. Ask questions that are curious, eager to learn questions, not loaded ones. Not, how can you possibly think that, but tell me about. What has brought you? What gave you this? And then learn from each other. You know, likewise, it isn't my job to tear down your God boxes. I mean, that's not my job as a pastor with Fabric. My job is to walk around your room, your God box with you, maybe with a little paint scraper, kind of looking at the wall, knocking off some of the old dried peeling paint to find where the cracks are. Not to prove that there's something wrong, but maybe because those cracks are places where you're going to see beyond the box you're in right now. Maybe a place where it could be good to put a window or, who knows, even a door to what might be outside. What might be beyond it. So, your box, my box, they're always going to be lacking. Whatever God is incomprehensible and unspeakable. Our boxes will never quite nail it, but they can be helpful, and they're necessary for that next step. So, how does this God box expanding stuff work? I know, this is all pretty theoretical, but how do I go from here to here to here? You know, how do I move up from one to the other? And, well, all I can say is this. There are two postures that make a lot of difference in this for us. One is to go to the edge of my box that's way out here someplace and then stand at it, put my back up to the wall, and look at my box and just admire it. And just feel comfortable. This is my terrain. It's familiar. I get it. And all the stuff that's going on in the world that maybe doesn't seem like it quite fits, I just reinterpret it to fit what I already know and what I already believe and what I already think, the limits of my language, whatever it might happen to be. All right? And if there's stuff that I just can't reconcile, I just find good ways of ignoring it. I don't hang out with those people. I don't read that kind of stuff. I don't listen to it. I try not to think about it. We have lots of ways of numbing ourselves to that sort of stuff. The other posture is to do a similar thing. It's to walk to the edge, explore my room, find the edge of my room, and then from here, look out. Use my box not as a bunker that can keep my life comfortable and safe and undisturbed, but a platform to discover what could be next. Good place to cut a window in that wall there. Now, hint about all this. When you look out that window to what's beyond, you are never going to see it all, even though sometimes it sort of feels like that. You know, the Buddhists have that concept of enlightenment, and but that enlightenment isn't ever like actually becoming one with all things, nothing separating you, experiencing the world and the universe and all things like Yahweh, I am who I am, does. No, it's what that enlightenment is, that it's that aha, it's those insights, it's those understandings that wake up within you when you have those moments and you can see beyond what you ever saw before and you don't really know how to make sense of it yet, but you feel it and you feel the wonder, you feel the twinge, you feel the glimpse of something that you inside knew was there waiting for you all along. It's looking out of your God box to what might be in the next one. So don't judge your God box. Instead, the third thing here is try your box out, test it, and share it. Share it. I mean, the best way to test it is to have to express it to another person, have it make sense to somebody else, and try to help them see what you have seen. So that way you learn from it, and you discover both its strengths and its weaknesses. Discover its strengths and weaknesses. And don't hide from those flaws that you find. I mean, that's such a human thing. Hide from our flaws. Try to defend our bad theology or our half-baked ideas. When something doesn't add up regarding how you used to understand, I don't know, heaven and hell, sin, God, the Bible, that particular Bible verse, something about how God works in the world, the purpose of rituals, traditions, you know, that list can go on and on. When you find something that doesn't really add up, acknowledge it. Those things are clues to what can be explored next. They're clues to maybe where the remodeling in your life can be happening next. That's good stuff. It's good stuff to know. And then also, don't get too attached to the strengths that you've got in your God box. I mean, celebrate them and explore them further, but be prepared for them to reveal the longer you live with them, that they aren't the thing either, and they lead you to something else. It's kind of like holding an egg and say, this is I've got, and then all of a sudden it hatches and flies away on you, right? Be ready to chase it. See where it goes. See where it leads you. Don't lock it in. So this all sounds kind of like a grand, wonderful thing of, you know, philosophical, intellectual challenge to keep making a bigger and bigger God box and kind of getting proud of yourself for it. But the truth is, what we're talking about here is like really deep down stuff. I mean, whether you see yourself as a religious person or not, the kind of stuff that we're talking about, the kind of stuff that is in these boxes, is the stuff that's really at the root of your being. These are the things where you find meaning, you find fulfillment, you find your footing in the world and among people around these things. You may use different language than the Bible does or that religious language uses, but those are the same things. So when you start messing with that, it hurts. It hurts. When you grow your box, you're losing something. And losing something always comes with a fair amount of pain with it, a pain at the same time. One of the ways I've experienced that with people is that when I see them start letting go of a superhuman version of God, you know, the God that kind of whips in and does a miracle or, you know, changes the laws of physics in order to make some kind of a miracle happen, when they start letting go of that a little bit, they don't know what to replace it with. And they'll accuse the people that are starting to crack that vision of God with, well, you're just trying to turn God into the laws of nature. And God isn't just the laws of nature. Yeah, you're right. God isn't just the laws of nature. But maybe the problem isn't that move is either right or wrong, but is it perhaps that we're trying to judge what our next box is going to look like and what it's going to show us about the world from the comfort level we had in our old box? We're just not there yet. Of course, some of these new ideas are going to take time. They aren't the old shoes that are all broken in and comfortable. These are new ones that you've got to walk in a while. You've got to figure out what they're like. They need to mold to you, and you need to start learning from those. Losing this personalized, human-like picture of God isn't just a head trip, like I say. It can mess with big parts of your life, like prayer. For instance, if God, Yahweh, the job of prayer isn't to just like bend God's ear and get God to do something for you that God wouldn't have done otherwise, but is because you prayed about it. Or we're all praying for someone's, you know, Aunt Susie who has this condition, and if, you know, 1,362 of us pray, then God will do it. You know, so I got to add mine on there, you know, my vote for Aunt Susie. If we start giving up that, well, what is prayer? I mean, what is its purpose? And how does it work? And does it mean I can't say I'll be praying for you anymore? I mean, so when we get there, we feel stuck. We don't know what to do with it. And we maybe go back to our old God box because we knew how to operate in that one. We're just going to close off these new ideas and these thoughts that we were having before. But maybe there is a way forward on all of that. I mean, maybe you're realizing, maybe the fact that you're asking these questions and it's so troubling and disturbing you is telling you that you're finally starting to think about something that your heart always knew and was trying to get you to think about and is trying to pull you on to a deeper understanding of and of participation with God that you didn't have before. So maybe your prayers never were convincing God to do something that God wouldn't do otherwise. You know, maybe prayer isn't just a vote for a person or a cause that you want to help, bending God's ear or getting God's attention. Maybe your prayers are just about you. Maybe it's creating a space so that God has enough, surface area with you, that God starts changing who you are, and that's the purpose of prayer. Or maybe prayer is a way of opening you to a depth of understanding and connecting you with a bigger perspective of your being, molding you to be able to know how to be available and support and walk with him, helping you understand what it means for your life to be woven with others and with God, and it's all kind of really big and stuff like that. And it isn't about, you know, helping that person be physically well again or to get their job back or mend their broken relationship, but it's about knowing how to be with each other through these kinds of things. And a lot of Jesus prayers seem to be like that. Or maybe it's different than that, and I don't know what that is. I mean, I don't know. I'm still working on a God box to help me with all this stuff. I haven't got it figured out. I don't have the biggest one yet. There's always one bigger. But I will say that our metaphor of fabric and our weaving ourselves with others in that third strand is helping me imagine building a bigger one. And it seems to be a metaphor that helps me keep knowing that weaving is going to keep going on and on and on to something beyond the box that I'm living in right now. And I also have to say that having a community like you to do this with, not only to think about this stuff and to talk about this stuff, but to live real life with, so that we don't just head exercise, but we actually go through some of our real life stuff with each other, helps me figure out, one, what stuff is actually meaningful, and two, that I can do this. I feel your support. I feel strength from you guys. I feel like you're giving me the capacity to do some of this stuff so that it's a life-giving process, not one that just wears me out and discourages me. So how does this all look? Well, you know, with prayer, you can have the little box. I'm going to wear God down with prayer till God will do what I finally want. Little bit bigger box, maybe. I'm opening myself up. I'm that prayer time. Let's kind of me hear God speak to me. Or a little bit bigger one where I start seeing what that weaving is like and what it means to be part of all things or something else or something else or something else. I mean, I don't know. Those are examples. Those are possibilities, and we all have our own paths through that. But all of these are ways of talking and thinking about God, what God's love is about, what prayer is about, how to read the Bible, why to read the Bible, what makes something the Word of God, what do we do with all these other world religions, what do we do with people without religion. Those are only some of the things that these God boxes try to help us sort out. But another thing that we find in these God boxes that I think we need to learn to live with is doubt. Doubt. Doubt has long been seen as the enemy of faith, challenging things that we're supposed to believe. And frankly, I'm not worried about that. I'm not worried about being challenged by things that I'm not supposed to believe. If something is truly a part of what God is, what I am, who I am is, and it's aligned with all that, then I challenge away. I mean, it's going to stand. It's the questions that are going to crumble and the questions that are going to get me to it. And if it's not, it will erode. And that's good stuff. We wanted that to happen in the first place. That's what it was about. Folks, doubt doesn't threaten faith. What does doubt threaten? Your God box. Doubt threatens your God box, and that's a good thing. Doubt is not an enemy of faith, it is a tool of faith, and that's your fill-ins there. Doubt is not an enemy of faith, it's a tool of faith. A tool that tears down something that you've already built and helps you have the raw materials to build whatever is next. So, and you know what else is a tool for this difficult process of our God box tearing down and building? It's what I mentioned just a minute ago. It's us. It's us. So tearing down and rebuilding your God box can only be done by you. It's your task. But don't do it alone. Don't do it alone. We need to be together on this stuff. You aren't the only one asking these questions. You aren't the only one with the hopes, the fears, the worries, the challenges of life. You have other people that can learn alongside you and people that need you to learn alongside them. There are people who have already been there and they can be mentors for you. And there are people who need you to show them something that you've discovered so that they maybe can feel permission to ask questions that their heart has been trying to ask all along but didn't feel permission. Maybe they couldn't even admit them to themselves. The word of Yahweh might come to them through the still small voice that is yours. It's good stuff. It's how it works. So your God box, they get a lot littler and they get a lot bigger, right? So what's your God box? Is it big? Is it little? Is it old? Is it new? Doesn't matter much. It's your starting point. It's where you are. Use it. Learn from it. Replace it. And my prayer for you, like Paul's that we mentioned last week, would be that you would begin to have the ability to comprehend the breadth and the length, the height and the depth of God's love, so that you, in doing that, could be filled with the fullness of God. Not that you'd be believing the right stuff, not that you'd come to church more often, not that you'd be a better Christian or a better whatever you happen to see yourself on. Nothing that is placed on the outside of you that tells you you ought to be it, but what comes from the inside, that place where you intersect with I am who I am and begins to grow up and swell up and dwell within you and help you discover who you are and what you're about.
Thanks for listening. We hope this podcast sparks conversation in other parts of your life. If you're looking for meaningful connections, there's a Fabric group for you to try, whether you're in the Twin Cities or not. Tag @FabricMPLS with your wanderings on social media and find resources on our website, fabricmpls.com.